This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 59 of What's It Like. My guest is Doug LeBeau. Somewhere in Santa Clarita?
Santa Clarita, California.
He is at the other end of LA from me. He's by Magic Mountain, and I am by the Newport Beach. We're going to take the ferry to Catalina. In between us is a lot of traffic. How you doing, Doug?
I'm good. How are you, Ken?
I'm all right. So, did you grow up in this area?
I've been in Southern California since 1975. I came out here to be a freshman at California State University at Northridge. And my family happened to move out here coincidentally at the same time.
Oh.
But I grew up in New England. I was born in Boston. I'm a lifelong Red Sox fan. And I grew up and went to high school in Westport, Connecticut. Went to a great performing arts high school in Westport, Connecticut. And then came out here in 1975, and I've been out here ever since.
Did you come from a large family?
Mother, father, and a younger sister. And then later, when I was already in my 20s, my uncle passed away, and my mom and dad then raised my two younger cousins, who are 20 years younger than me, as my younger brothers. And we still have that kind of a relationship today.
Wow, that's nice. So looking at your childhood, who had the largest influence on your life?
Oh, that's a great question. In my family, I would probably say it was my mom. My dad was on the road a lot. But the person who probably had the most influence on what I wanted to do with my life was probably the musician James Taylor. I wanted to be a singing, guitar-playing troubadour like him, and spent a lot of time, you know, kind of down that road before I kind of took a U-turn out of popular music and went into the commercial music business.
So what was your biggest challenge as a child?
My biggest challenge as a child was probably the not really close relationship I had with my dad. Probably the biggest challenge that I had. My dad traveled a lot, and when he was in town, he and I didn't really get along that well. And that was that was emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually a big challenge for me.
Yeah. Did you find a replacement dad?
No, I didn't find a replacement dad, but I did get very involved in music and theater in school and spent a lot of time doing that. And I grew up, and so did my dad, and later we became good friends.
Oh.
Took him a lot longer to grow up than it took me, I think.
What was school like for you?
You know, I'm a smart guy. I was a gifted kid. I have two gifted kids, so I see it play out with them. I kind of skated along in junior high school and high school because what I really wanted to do was be an artist. I really wanted to play music, and I really wanted to act and sing. And if it wasn't that, I kind of just got by on my being a very well-read intellectual. And in college, I started down that same road of really only caring about what happened in music classes or in theater classes or on stage. But I also got very involved in college and special education, found out that I had a talent for being a sign language interpreter and studied special ed as a minor and spent most of my 20s working in the Los Angeles area as a sign language interpreter for the Greater Los Angeles Council on Deafness while I was, you know, continuing to act and play music evenings and weekends. And then I went back to school. I was fortunate to start to get work as a film composer in my late 20s and got a pretty good contract with an industrial company making movies for General Motors. When I was in my late 20s, I got a pretty good like 2-year assignment scoring these industrial films for General Motors and decided to use that money and the time to go back to school. So I went to the Grove School of Music, which was at the time probably the best professional music conservatory in the country, a place designed for people who knew that they wanted to make their living as a working musician, whether that was in the area of film and TV or playing as a gigging musician or being an arranger, composer, producer. It was a great school for that. And when I went to the Grove School of Music, I discovered the inner student that I had never been, because I had an incredible mentor who said to us, look, I'm not going to just teach you everything I know about music. I'm going to teach you everything I know about learning. And you can apply that to whatever you do for the rest of your life. And I'm going to teach you a working method of attacking every challenge and situation that comes to you so that you understand how to learn anything that comes up for you. And it was really a formula for success. And I went from being a mediocre student who was just a very smart guy to being a straight A student who also was learning and practicing the craft of being a composer, producer, arranger at a very high practical level as well. That experience of going to the Grove School of Music for a two-year programs, a year in their composing and arranging program, which I graduated from with high honors, and then a year in their film composition program, which I also graduated from with high honors. That 2 years really changed my life. It changed me because I learned the value of hard work. I learned the value of applying myself in a very smart way when it was appropriate to work hard and when it was appropriate to think hard, and how to take any situation that came to me as a composer or producer, or and then I've subsequently gone on to school and become a religious science minister as well, and I'm the music minister as well at the NoHo Arts Center for New Thought in North Hollywood, California. But it gave me the opportunity to learn to be my own mentor in any situation, and that was a really important breakthrough for me.
So what was the secret to learning everything?
The secret to learning everything is that you don't have to know. Dick Grove, who was my mentor, said, you don't have to know everything. You just have to remember what drawer you left the instructions in.
That's true.
And so as a musician, and I don't know if your study is so much about musicianship or about other, you know, all different types of careers, but let me tell it to you from the point of view of a musician. He would say, the components of music are, of course, melody and harmony, and style and rhythm, and another thing that he called contour, which was the glue that kept it all together. And he'd say, what I'm going to do is I'm going to develop and teach you how to use your melodic ear, your harmonic ear, your stylistic ear, your rhythmic ear, and the ear that understands contour. And you'll be able to apply these skills to anything, because you'll understand when someone's talking to you in a conversation what they're asking for and what they're saying. And in any given moment, you have to be able to trust that even if you don't know how to do what it is that someone wants you to do, you'll certainly learn it and become expert in it before the time that you're required to demonstrate that. It doesn't matter what you do. And I apply that today by saying, you know, my natural style of music to write in and work in is a combination of pop, orchestra, and jazz. I work, my full-time gig is that I'm a producer, composer, singer, songwriter, recording artist for Disney. I work for Disney Publishing Worldwide. I've written hundreds of songs for Disney children's music. But in the realm of children's music, you have to be able to write everything. You have to be able to write for an orchestra. You have to be able to write jazz. You have to be able to write bluegrass. You have to be able to write and sing pop. But kind of being a white guy from the East Coast, the natural style of music for me isn't necessarily like hip hop or rap. And yet, if I get an assignment to do that, because I've been trained as a musician to understand melody and harmony and rhythm and contour and style, I can listen to what works in terms of that kind of music, and I can write and produce something that's credible and usable as a commercial musician, and that my clients at Disney will want me to use, like I can in jazz or bluegrass or, you know, country, funk, folk. But to apply this entire lesson to just working in the business or working in life in general, it's that, you know, again, you don't have to know everything. You just have to remember what drawer you put those instructions in. And what that means is you have to know how to research. You have to know where your references are. You have to be able to understand that in any given moment, you might need some information and to ask for it or to go look for it.
Mm-hmm. So how does the process actually work? Does Disney come to you and say, I have this project. I want you to write in this particular kind of style.
Well, the project that I'm working on for Disney and have been for the last 4 years is a project called Disney English. And what Disney English is, we've just completed the flagship curriculum for Disney English. Disney English is a Disney consumer product, which they've just premiered over the last 3 years in China. And what it is a chain of after school English as a second language program schools. Mm. And the way that it works is, as an example, is that Disney will use all of their popular movies and records as the basis of this project. And so a kid in Shanghai will go to the Disney school 3 or 4 afternoons a week after school. And on a Monday, they might show them Toy Story. And they'll just watch the movie and then maybe ask some questions about the characters and the story. And they'll watch it either in English with subtitles or they'll watch it dubbed in Mandarin. And then on the next afternoon, they'll come in and they'll start to work on projects and activities based in the universe of Toy Story, but with new songs and new chants. Chants are like songs that are spoken in rhythm, kind of like a rap, but, you know, like, and if the vocabulary words for that particular afternoon might be morning, evening, noon, and night, they might have a chant that goes like this. With a rhythm, it might go morning, evening, noon, night. What do you do in the morning? What do you do in the evening? And that's set to music, but they're a repetitive type of either song, you know, and if they tell me that the particular afternoon's activities might be centered on the idea of travel and that they're using scenes from The Incredibles where the family of The Incredibles travels all over the world, and they might ask me to, and they'll say, we'd like a rock and roll song, and I might do like, when will you be going on a vacation? When will you be going on a trip? When will you be going on a cruise? When will you be going on a tour? And then write a rock and roll song with backing vocals and all that stuff based in the universe that they want, because the score for that particular movie likes a rock and roll type of feel to it. So they'll give me what they call a scope and a sequence, meaning the words that exist in the lesson plan at this time. And they'll give me also kind of sentence structures that are allowed at this level. And then I have to go and write the songs based on and score and produce and play the instruments and either have my own kids come in and sing with me or my wife or do all the vocals myself. So it's an interesting compositional job that involves some bare bones information from them about the universe that we're working in, which is usually the Toy Story universe, the Peter Pan universe, the, you know, the Incredibles universe, or any one of the other, you know, Snow White. There's, you know, we've been using all of these movies and projects. And I also, as an example for younger children, they asked me to write a series of counting songs to be sung by Mickey and Minnie, Minnie Mouse and Mickey Mouse, and also my son and another young lady, Emerson Bronskill, my son Jesse LeBeau, and another young lady, Emerson Bronskill. And the four of them, Mickey and Minnie and Emerson and Jesse, counted. And these songs, each one of these songs counts to a certain level, and they like the song that goes, you know, 1, 2, da ba ba da ba, 1, 2, da da da, 1, 2. One, I mean, and then they count all the way up to 20, and I had to come up with a song that could be adapted. I think the song went kind of like 1, 2, 1, 2. You know, just the entire song developed through an entire universe of counting all the way up to 20. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, all the way up through. So they give me an idea, and then they ask me to come up with something musical that will fit. Either a video or an activity or a game. They make, of course, this is Disney. They make their own board games. They make, you know, all the stuff that goes into the schools. But the stuff that I write for them is the kind of soundtrack. And some of it's orchestral music and some of it's actual songs and some of it is chants and stuff like that.
Do you usually work at home or do you go to a studio?
I work at home 99.9% of the time in my studio here. I have a very nice compositional studio that I'm sitting in right now, and I have, you know, recording booth, and I also, in addition to doing this stuff, I also have a business-to-business production company called LeBeau Music and Multimedia, in which I produce all kinds of videos for my current client list involves Infiniti Cars and Nissan and a software company called Xtime. And so I do a lot of like business-to-business training videos and promotional videos for their trade shows and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I was music director on General Hospital at ABC TV for 5 years, and I scored like about 635 episodes of that show. And I sat in production meetings on that show for 5 years. So I learned a lot of the other jobs that are in the production, you know, that are around the production table, including being a cinematographer and a lighting director. And I can sew a costume. And
if someone wanted to have that kind of job, what kind of equipment would you have to have?
For the kind of job that I have?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of equipment? Well, I mean, the modern composer's studio involves usually most of the time a really nice Macintosh computer as the core of it, although there are some guys that work on the Windows side, but most of the guys that I know, most of the guys that I work with have, you know, as a composer, you have a room that usually has a nice computer in it, and that computer has a lot of software on it, a digital audio workstation software. Like I use Digital Performer. A lot of people use Pro Tools or Cubase mm-hmm. or Sonar, but digital audio workstation. And nowadays, rather than using hardware, most of the guys that do what I do have a large library of sampled sound sets and what are called virtual instruments. Virtual instruments are themselves music applications which can be either used by themselves or inside a host software application, which is that aforementioned digital audio workstation like Pro Tools or Digital Performer, where you can use these plugins mm-hmm. is the word that's used. And plugins like that make all the sampled sounds that you use for the stuff you do, guitars and basses and drums and pianos and you know, strings and woodwinds and brass and percussion and all that stuff. The modern studio, a lot of times, I know we're on Skype and you're just working audio, but I've got my camera here. You can see this. You know, a lot of times you have like a big, you know, mixing console like you see over here. My mixing console nowadays mostly is the place where I store sheet music that I'm working on or scores that I'm working on, because almost everything is done inside the computer now. And with a virtual mixing console inside your digital audio workstation. But I also use a lot of I use Sibelius, which is the music notation software that I use to produce songbooks and scores and sheet music and parts for live performances. And I do a lot of music engraving and arranging and transcribing. Most of the people who are in the music business, the large majority of people who work in the music business don't really read and write music very well. Most people who work in the popular music business who can write and sing and play an instrument do so mostly by ear. Either they studied music as a child and they might retain some music literacy, but most of the people in the professional entertainment industry, except for people who specifically do the kind of stuff that I do, are fairly musically illiterate. And so for someone like me who is a very musically literate person who can listen to music and write it down and then put it in the computer and make beautiful, you know, engraved sheet music, that's a pretty rare thing nowadays. So there's always stuff like that to do for me, because I've always got and in my music ministry at the Spiritual Center, where I'm the music director and also the music minister, I would say probably 90%+ of the music that we perform has never been written down before. So people come to me with MP3s or an album and say, hey, I'd really love to sing this song. And there's never been any sheet music for it. So I, you know, listen to it, transcribe it, make an arrangement of it, and then we perform it live. So that's another kind of software that I use in the studio. Most composers have some kind of a workstation that they work at, either a desk or some kind of a custom-made. I have a custom-made, you know, studio with custom-made furniture in it that was made by the guy who was the studio designer at ABC TV when I worked there. While I was working on General Hospital, I contacted the guy who designed my studio there and said, I'd like to build a studio at my house, and I'd like you to come and measure me and ergonomically create, you know, the place where I work every day, the furniture that I sit at, with my keyboard, my music keyboard, where I can play music, and where I can also have my, you know, computer keyboard and mouse and in front of a battery of large monitors that are in front of me, and where I can have scores, you know, score paper that I work from and write, and also a desk right next to it where I can pick up a pencil and a piece of paper if I want to, you know, write something down. So I have a custom-made room that, I don't know, like, again, you can't, and nobody else can see this. You can see this. I have a wall over here with all my books, you know, orchestration books and arranging books and books on, and also years and years and years worth of sheet music that I've collected from all the sheet music I've bought over the years, that when someone comes to me and says, hey, can you do me an arrangement of such and such a song, that I have that sheet music or that I know where to get it. And also have a big stand-up desk over there, which is where I, when I print out, and a big format printer where I can print, you know, scores and parts for all the projects that I work on as a music director or a composer, arranger, and a big stand-up desk where I can stand up and tape parts together and put booklets together for choral, you know, rehearsals and things that I do where I'm the conductor and music director, stuff like that.
Where do you keep the Emmy?
It's on the wall over there. I was too far down the list to actually get the statue, but I got the plaque, which is what you get after. It's that big metal brass plaque up on the wall right over there.
That's still nice.
It's very nice when people come in and go, oh, you won an Emmy. So it's very nice to have been considered that something that I worked on was worthy to have been awarded, and I like having it up on the wall there.
I have a friend who won an Oscar.
Very nice.
But it was the same thing. It's a group. And so the head gets the statue to keep, and everybody else gets a more commemorative plaque.
The plaque. That's right. Yes. when I called them up and I said, so can't I get the statue? And they said, no, but you can always say that you're an Emmy winner. Like, very nice. You know.
What's the best thing about your job?
The best thing about my job is that I get to support my family doing what I love to do. And as you well know, living in the Los Angeles area, anytime that you can work and live in the Los Angeles area without having to subject yourself to 2+ hours of commuting a day, that's a gift.
Yep.
And I work at home 99% of the time. I do leave home on Sundays, of course, to go run a big music program at my spiritual center. And I do go down to the San Fernando Valley a couple of nights a week, Tuesday nights to teach a class, and Wednesday nights to do a midweek service a couple times a month. But most of the time, I'm home when my kids come home from school in the afternoon, and that's a gift. I have a 14-year-old who's a freshman at Valencia High School here in Santa Clarita, and I have an 11-year-old who's a graduating sixth grader at Mountain View Elementary School. And I live in a nice, safe neighborhood where I can work at home on a beautiful day like today when the sun is shining outside my studio, and where my kids come home at 3:30 in the afternoon and I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife, who is also a minister and who is a marriage and family therapist here in California, and her practice is half out of the house, and then she spends a lot of time with clients on the phone and doing email and stuff like that. So for the 20 years we've been married, my wife and I have both shared a space at home. We're in and out of each other's space throughout the course of the day. We also have a 21-year-old niece who lives with us, who's a Canadian. My wife's a Canadian, and my kids also have Canadian citizenship. But I also have a 21-year-old niece who's a college student here in Southern California and who is also a champion drag racer.
Oh, my.
She's a very talented and beautiful young lady who lives with us as well while she's going to school here and exploring her career as a drag racer, as a race car driver.
What's the worst thing about your job?
The worst thing about my job is when several projects, and I've been very, very fortunate over the years to become very close friends with almost everybody that I work with. So I get a lot of repeat business from, like, the job that I have at Disney is because a lady that I worked with producing children's CDs over at Price Stern Sloan a number of years ago, and that's the company that used to make Mad Libs, if you remember Mad Libs.
Oh, yes.
And when she got her job as an executive producer at Disney, she called me up and said, I want to work with you again, and now I have a project we can work on. And so over the years, most of my clientele have become my close friends. So after the first couple times we worked together, it's really like working with your buddies. And so the worst thing about my job is when too many projects are on the exact same deadline. And when there's literally not enough time during the week or the day for me to feel that I'm able to give my best to everything that I'm doing, and I tend to stress myself out, because the best thing about the projects that I work on is that I've become really close friends with all of my clients. And the worst thing is that I've become really close friends with all my clients, and I don't want to let anybody down. And so that's the toughest part of my job when I'm facing a situation like that over the course of the next 2 months, where I've got a very large video project for Nissan that I'm producing, and I've got an extended project for Disney for a new app that they're creating for the iPhone and the iPad that'll be coming out next year, and that I have kind of conflicting schedules and want to sneak in a vacation in November with my wife to Mexico for a week. And I also am being asked to play a role in a children's theater production at my spiritual center, over the holidays, called Yo Ho Ho, A Pirate's Christmas, which is a wonderful award-winning Samuel French published children's production that I've been resisting being in for the last 5 years. They want me to play Murray Christmas, who is who's the Jewish elf. Which is, and since I was brought up Jewish, they want me to play, apparently the role was actually written with me in mind, but I've always declined to play Murray Christmas. But this year they're asking me, because my 11-year-old son wants to be the lead in the show this year. He's old enough to play it. And so when too many things are on my plate, that's the worst part of my career. Because I like to do everything, and I don't want to disappoint anybody or turn anything down. And I like to make a good living. So the best times are when all the projects just seem to line up like this. One is done and the next one starts, and then that one's done and the next one starts, and that one's done and the next one starts. And that's an ideal schedule for a guy like me, but it doesn't always happen that way.
What type of person would be good at your job?
Well, someone who's self-directed, someone who is a good time manager, because my career is filled with long-form projects. Projects that I know are 2, 3, 4, 5, 6-week, 7-week, 8-week, 2-month, 3-month project. And to be successful, you have to be able to manage your time as well as manage budgets. I mean, anytime you're a producer, I'm sure – I don't know if you interviewed any other producers, but people think that, producing is glamorous, and the end result of what you do often is a glamorous, experience at the end of your production. But to be a successful producer requires not only having the skills in the music and the video business of being able to really know a good song, a good video, a good cut, a good script, a good director when you meet one, a good actor when you meet them, a good singer, a good player that you want to work with. It's also important to be a good money manager and understand how to budget and spend yours and the client's money. And I say yours and the client's because in this day and age of projects that are mostly package deals, where they tell you, this is how much money we have for the project that you're going to work on. And so you need to be able to decide whether you can spend that money wisely and still make a living, or whether you're going to be upside down on that project and it's not going to be a worthwhile project for you, or if there's some negotiation involved. But most importantly is the relationship between time and money. Is there time in the day to sleep, to eat, to parent, to do work on yourself, and also to know that if you're working on a project that goes over a several week or several month period, how are you doing with it? Are you on schedule? Are you in the weeds today? Are you like, boy, because, all of us in many different types of jobs, a lot of people spend a lot of time in front of their computer. I do a lot because I do all my production in my computer, and I also do a lot of my music writing in my computer, and I do a lot of my music notation in my computer. And then also as a minister, I write sermons in front of my computer, and I do budgeting in front of my computer. And it's easy, just in the course of this conversation, you've probably heard a couple of emails come in, and it's easy to get lost, Internet Explorer or Safari on the Macintosh or Firefox is only a click away. And the world, all of the world's information is available right now. And that's a good thing. If I need a piece of information for work, I can get to it instantaneously. I can also check and see what the baseball scores are at any time, too. And so being a good time manager and knowing where you are in your project and knowing and being able to say, today I must get to here if I want to go in and have dinner with my family. Because my kitchen's right across the courtyard from my front door here in my studio. And for me to say, I need to get to here today to know that I'm on track and to be able to say at dinner time, all right, I'm here. I can go and have dinner with my family or I can then spend the evening with my family, you know, watching some TV or going over my son's homework or hanging out with my wife or taking a swim in the summertime or whatever it is. To know what your time frame is, to know that it's okay now to take the rest of the day off, or no, you know what? What will really make me feel better is to come back here after dinner and spend another half an hour just sewing this last little bit up so that I know that I made it to the end of my day today successfully. And then when you're self-employed, the flip side of being a good time manager is also being willing to stand up for yourself and take some time off. And make sure that you have some recreation time. Because, you know, the word recreation literally means to recreate ourselves, to allow ourselves to regenerate themselves overnight. You know, sometimes it's important to just put your behind on the couch and put your feet up and have your family all together to watch, you know, Modern Family or The Big Bang Theory or Saturday Night Live or something like that and have a laugh. But money management and time management are the things that make an independent composer, producer, or an independent director, cinematographer, or an independent video editor, you know, a viable working professional. You got to be able to get the gigs. You got to be able to do the gigs. But in the course of doing them, you also got to be able to deliver them on time. And you got to be able to keep your clients aware of where you're at with it. So good time and money management are very important.
Since you've inspired me, if I decided I wanted to get your job, how would I go about doing that?
And that's a good question. You know, I've been on lists for several music schools and universities for years because friends of mine that I went to school with are now professors at, you know, Berklee College of Music in Boston and other music schools. And sometimes one of their students will say, I'm heading to L.A., and they'll say, well, if you're going to go to L.A., here's Doug LeBeau's telephone number. Call him up and tell him I sent you, and he'll take you out for lunch, and he'll tell you what's what. And one of the very first things that I do when someone comes to my studio is I shake their hand and I hand them my business card. And then I wait for them to give me their business card. And in 100% of the cases over the last 20 years, this young guy or gal who's wanted to take my job has come to L.A. and ready to take over and be the next me. And they've not had a business card, nor have they. I mean, approaching it like a business is a very important thing. You know, I'll walk up to guys in a bank, you know, and they're standing in front of me and they're talking about getting funding for their project. And I'll listen and they'll say, yeah, we've got the script and we've got the director and we're ready to go. And I'll hand the guys my business card and I'll say, you don't know me, but here's my card. Here's my website. I'm an Emmy award-winning composer. Look me up. I might not be the right guy for your job, but you should check me out. You know, you got to be willing to stand up for yourself. I'd say to have my job, one, you really to have my job as a producer, composer, arranger, songwriter, recording artist in LA, who's not really, you know, interested in having a hit record, you know, because that's a different job. You know, coming to LA and wanting to get a hit record or be a star of a TV show or go on American Idol. You know, I'm 54 years old, so I'm a lot older than American Idol. But the truth is to have my job, which is composer, arranger, producer, music director, conductor, the very first thing I would say is you must, absolutely must, be a superbly trained and educated musician, first of all. Mm-hmm. You must have gone to music school or graduated from a university somewhere with a degree in music and an emphasis on composition, arranging, or teaching, but you must be fluent, really fluent in the language of music, which is manuscript. You have to be able to read and write music, and writing music, and a lot of people who can read it really can't write it. And I don't mean composition, because people can sit at the guitar or sit at the piano, and they can come up with a song. They can come up with a piece of instrumental music, but that's not what I'm talking about. That's important, of course, being able to create music. But what I'm talking about is the ability to write music, to have a piece of paper and a pencil, and when someone plays you a melody, to be able to write it down and understand that what is being performed, that there is a language that allows you to notate that clearly and correctly. And, you know, many of the very fine musicians in this town who work a lot either never did have or have lost the ability to do that, to write music down. And so they got to hire guys like me. So if you want to take my job, you have to be able to do that. You have to be able to read and write music very fluently. You also, to have my job in today's world, you must have a very clear understanding of the science of computer-centric studio, which is you have to understand acoustics. You have to understand how to use music production software and music notation software. You have to be able to fluently use on a daily basis a complex, either Windows or Mac, but I would say really Mac, computer-based system to which you can get digital audio in and out of. You must understand all of the related video, how to score to picture, how to create and use video, whether it's created in Final Cut Pro or in iMovie, or you have to understand the language of production. You have to know lighting. You have to know, as I said before, costumes. You have to understand blocking. You have to understand how to deal with directors and producers and cinematographers and video editors. And if you're one of those yourself, because there's a lot of people who cross over, you have to understand those jobs as well. I'm kind of uniquely positioned because not only am I a composer and producer of music, but I'm also a producer and director and editor of video. And I've directed a lot of live theater and live concerts as well as a conductor and also as a director, someone who's directed plays and studied theater in my undergraduate years. So to take my job, first of all, you have to be a Renaissance person who is interested in the arts and who is very well educated. And you have to be more educated than most of the people that you do business with, because most of the people you do business with as a composer are afraid of the music because it's not something they can do. It's not something that they understand. And so you have to also have good people skills and be able to explain what's going to happen before it happens and explain how the money's going to be spent and also explain and stand up for why that money is necessary and how it's going to be used.
So, Doug, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Wonderful question. Well, you know, my mentor, Dick Grove, used to say, there's no downbeat without music on the stands. And what that means is you can hire a great band and put them in the studio, but if they got nothing to play, you know, he used to say, fear is a great motivator. And that in this town, you know, you only get one chance to make it. And I take a little bit of a different view on that. The glue for it for me is, of course, spiritually based. I did go back to school and become a minister, a religious science minister, and I am very interested in teaching people what I call practical spirituality. I was raised as a Jew, and I loved being Jewish, and I loved being in temple because I loved the music. But I also realized that for me, and only for me, and I don't speak for anybody else, and I never would assume anybody else's spiritual, you know, life is valid or invalid for them. But for me personally, other than being brought up in Judaism, other than, you know, to be a good person, do good work, do charitable work, I didn't necessarily find the spiritual tools in the way that I was brought up for when I was having a bad day. And when I was maybe facing a tough self-opinion on a particular day. Maybe when I got out of bed and really didn't feel that I was up to the challenge of my day, or up to the challenge of my career, or up to the challenge of my marriage, or up to the challenge of parenthood. So for me, what I did was I started studying metaphysics, spiritual metaphysics, and have followed that study for the last 20 years. And so what gets me out of bed is a good relationship with myself spiritually. And I don't want to get into, you know, because I don't know if it's an appropriate conversation to be having in this forum in terms of what you're interviewing me for. But, you know, metaphysics is a practical spirituality, a way that we can all of us learn to feel good about ourselves, learn to feel good about our relationship to the universe. And basically what metaphysics says is that God is all there is. So we're part of that, and that it's a cause and effect universe. So the way that we think manifests certain experiences in our lives. So by learning to think better thoughts about myself, I manifest a better experience on a daily basis. And that's what I try to teach people to do as well, to feel better about themselves and to manifest a better experience for themselves on a daily basis. And that's what I get up for.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Baseball's good. No, seriously, think about it. Baseball, watching a baseball game is something that you have to commit to for at least a couple of hours, maybe 3 or 4 hours. And it moves pretty slowly most of the time. And my mind moves pretty quickly. And so to force myself, but I also, that's not a joke. I mean, I really do during the baseball season love to take the time to watch a Boston Red Sox game. And now, of course, with the 21st century access we have on the internet to anything that we want, and I can buy a subscription to Major League Baseball and watch my favorite team, even though they're in Boston and I'm in California. But I meditate every day. I do what's called spiritual mind treatment, which is a metaphysical form of affirmative prayer. And I ride my motorcycle, and that I live on the opposite end of Los Angeles from you. And I live at pretty much the north end of L.A. County here in Santa Clarita, which, as you correctly pegged, was right here in the neighborhood of Magic Mountain, which is the big Six Flags theme park up here in the Santa Clarita Valley. But I actually live right. My neighborhood is a modern 10-year-old neighborhood. And I live in a beautiful house that's 10 years old. So it's a modern house right on the edge of the desert, right on the edge of – and I live right by a street here called San Francisco Canyon Road, which in 5 minutes I can be on my bike and out in the countryside. And pretty much every weekend I go out, sometimes alone and sometimes with one of my sons or sometimes with my wife. And I take a 2 or 3 hour motorcycle ride out in the country, and I just enjoy nature. And I allow that to be a spiritual way for me to quiet myself and to remind myself that I live in a beautiful world, and that everything in it, including me, is important to it.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Absolutely. After I left ABC in 2002, I spent the next 4 years very, very busy as a video producer, producing training videos for one of the largest banks in this country. And in September, I was so busy working for them that I didn't even have the opportunity to do any other business development during that time. So they gave me a very big basket, and they kept putting more and more eggs in it, to the point at which I had so many eggs in this basket that I had to be hiring lots and lots of people to help me do what I was doing. And we were all very busy doing very fun work and frankly making a lot of money doing it. And in September of 2006, this bank called me up and said, how much time do we have left on our contract? And I said, well, through this year and the next year. And they said, well, we're out of business. Sorry. We have no more work for you. And please don't even finish the work that you're working on right now. And we'll cut you a check for probably just a fraction of what we owe you, but we're done.
Oh, my.
And as I had said a minute ago, I had been so busy working for them at the time, for it had developed into such a busy and lucrative relationship that I didn't even take the time to make sure that I had. I had been saying no to all kinds of people on all kinds of things for probably at least 24 months. And, you know, if you say no, 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 people stop asking you. So at that point, I pretty much was out of work for the first time in my adult life. And now when you're an independent, self-employed person in the entertainment business, you do get used to the idea that your independence and the privilege of being an independent is partially paid for by the fact that you don't have a regular job. Mm-hmm. So the security of someone who has a regular job, a regular 9-to-5 style job, or their own company or something, where they go to work, you know, what you pay for, if you're a bank teller at Bank of America, say, it's a great job for someone who wants security and wants to go to work. But then again, you're tied to that venue all day long. And, you know, you have to, if you need to go to the doctor, you might have to ask permission, or you might have to schedule it in the evening or on a weekend. Your lunch hour is your lunch hour. I've been self-employed all these years, and I've been, as I said before, a very good time and money manager. So if I wanted to take a day off and go ride my motorcycle in the middle of the week or play golf, I don't play golf anymore, but that's an example. I always had the opportunity to do that because I've been self-employed. So at this point, I had become inadvertently kind of like a big company executive of my own company. And all of a sudden, my company's only real client called up and said, we're out of business. Oh, well, sorry. And it was a company called Countrywide Home Loans, which I made a lot of training videos for. And they all of a sudden didn't need any training videos because they were firing everybody. And the only people that were left working there for the next year or two were people at the executive vice president level. And they all knew how to do their job. They didn't need any training videos. So it challenged me because I had forgotten that one of the most important things about being an independent, self-employed person like myself is to always kind of be looking down the road. What's happening next year? What's happening in a couple of months? And I got blindsided. And while I was in a pretty decent, you know, I didn't lose my home and I didn't lose, you know, my cars and I didn't lose my ability to support my family, but it was the beginning of what many people are experiencing around this world and around this country, which is this perception that the economy is very, very bad. And I was on the bleeding edge of that, the leading edge of that, because I literally, coincidentally, was working for the industry that was creating that mortgage kind of meltdown, and they melted down first. Mm-hmm. And I was working for them, and I kind of created that meltdown for myself at that time. And fortunately, it only took me about a year to get back on my feet and be very, very busy again. But for the last quarter of 2006 and the most of 2007, I didn't work at my usual level of busyness. And the jobs that I did have didn't pay me what I was used to being paid. And it took me that entire kind of five quarters, the last quarter of 2006 and all of 2007, to be very busy again. And that was very challenging. That was very upsetting for me personally. It was very challenging for me spiritually. I wasn't a minister yet, but I was working on it. And it was very challenging for me to not make it all about my self-worth, you know, not make it about whether I was a good person or not. And I mean, that's a very important distinction. We're not what we do. We are who we are. And so it was very challenging to not have very destructive thoughts at that time about my own self-worth. And you're a psychologist and you know what that means.
Is there an idea or a principle that helped you through your challenges?
Absolutely. There's an idea and a principle that helped me through my challenges. And it's an idea and a principle that I use every day. And I mean, if you want me to go towards a spiritual discussion about it from the point of view of someone who's a licensed minister, I'll be happy to. But yes, I do. The principle, and that's an interesting word to use because that's the word that in religious science that we use, which is principle, because we often refer to the divine as the thing itself, principle, the principle. And what I teach and what we study is the principle of being. Going to that human joke about, you know, that we're human beings, we're not human doings. You know, we're always kind of expressing this divine principle in everything that we do. And that if, in fact, we do live in a universe that's created by a supreme consciousness and we're part of it, you know, whether you call it a pantheistic universe or a panentheistic universe that we live in, that either the universe itself is God or we live in a universe that is where God lives and we're part of it. Yeah, the principle that I live by and that I believe in is that there's no place that between God and me, there's no between. And that no matter, and that was spoken by a 12th century Catholic minister, Catholic priest who was a mystic, whose name was Meister Eckhart, Eckhart von Hochheim, who lived in the 12th century. And he very famously said, between God and me, there's no between. So what the principle that I dig down in is faith. Faith that everything that's happening to me is actually happening for me. And even though as a human being, sometimes I can't step far enough back from the trees to see a forest, I just see that tree that's bugging me or that tree that fired me or that tree that didn't hire me. But the truth is, it's a spiritual universe and everything that's happening to me is for my highest good. My job is to step farther and farther back from that tree line until I see it as a forest. And that forest is my higher good.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say?
I would say never, ever, ever schedule anything after a recording session. People have asked me for years, what sort of thing you can teach me about the music business.
I've been in a couple of recording sessions and I agree.
Never schedule anything after a recording session. And you know why? Because for those of us who are in the commercial music business, the recording session itself is the most important time to be present, the most important time to have your best ears listening, the most important time to be your most creative self, and to be able to roll with any punches that come up, whether you're recording the score for a big, you know, movie and, you know, the director and the producer are there, or whether you're just recording a vocalist for a little commercial or whatever it is, never ever schedule anything after a recording session, because either you'll be looking at the clock and not present in the moment at what you're supposed to be doing because you're worried that you're going to be late to something and your wife's going to be mad, or you will be so edgy and distracted in the session itself that you won't do your best work, or you will in fact both be edgy and distracted and not do your best work, and your wife will be mad that you didn't show up at whatever it is, PTA meeting, your son's baseball game, dinner out, whatever it is. So my rule is, never ever schedule anything after a recording session. Recording session starts at 1 and it may be scheduled to end at 5, and what's after the recording session is always the question mark.
My last question is really giving you an opportunity to say anything you wanted. Is there something you wanted to say that I haven't asked you?
You've asked some great questions, and of course I didn't always know whether you were asking me, because we didn't really talk before this interview, whether you're asking me specifically as a guy who's a composer and a producer, or whether you're asking me as a guy who's a composer and a producer who's also a practicing minister, or someone who's a father or a husband or all. But I would say it's been said before, but whatever's worth doing is worth doing well. Whether you're a student in school or whether you're a volunteer, it's like that adage from the theater, you know, no small roles, only small actors. That's what they say. Meaning that if you accept the responsibility of some kind of a job or a gig, do it well. Even if what your job is to be, you know, a two-line walk-on in a play that you're not getting paid for, if you say yes to it, do it well and without resentment. Do the best that you can. I would also say, unless you absolutely have to, don't waste your time doing things you hate to do. You won't do a good job. You won't have a good time. And I say unless you have to, because we all have to support our families. We all have to pay our rent. We all have to make a living and put food in our bodies. But find what makes you happy. Find your bliss and follow it, and all else will come. Because when you're passionate about what you do, because you love doing it. Even the long days don't seem so long. And even the tough challenges don't seem so challenging. Find out what you really, really like to do. You know, my 11-year-old is clear. If he can, you know, play with his computer and build roller coasters, he is going to be happy. So, you know, if he ends up designing roller coaster rides for some amusement company on a computer, he'll be really, really happy, and he won't care how much he gets paid or you know, there's a great book by a gentleman named Eric Butterworth called Spiritual Economics. Eric Butterworth was a Unity minister in New York City, and he wrote a great book called Spiritual Economics. And basically what he said was, you know, to be a really abundant person, find what you love, do it for the sake of doing it, and the universe will support you well. That's probably my best advice.
I want to thank Doug LeBeau for joining me today. Thanks, Doug. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.